National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the listeners of WKNO in Memphis and by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in enlightened leadership, transforming the future of children and community.
I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today's show could be called Learning from Canada. First, we'll talk to Larry Beasley from the City of Vancouver, where he is co-director of planning and director of current planning. Vancouver is frequently named by our guest as one of North America's most appealing cities, and we'll find out why when we talk to Larry Beasley. Then we'll talk to Tim Jones. He's CEO of Artscape, a Toronto organization that develops real estate and programs for the city's artist and creative sector. Tim will tell us about a worldwide conference to be held in Toronto September 30th and October 1st, Creative Places and Spaces, The Risk Revolution. Lessons from Vancouver and Toronto on how to build cities we love are our subject today on Smart City, right after this news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Larry Beasley is co-director of planning and director of current planning for the City of Vancouver. Among his recent initiatives are new land use and transportation plans that are dramatically reshaping Vancouver's inner city. The United Nations honored Larry's work in 1996 as one of the world's 100 best planning practices, and the Royal Architectural Institute of Canada conferred on him its 2003 Medal of Excellence as Advocate for Architecture. He's been appointed a member of the Order of Canada, the nation's highest honor for lifetime achievement. Many people, Larry, name Vancouver as the best North American city. What is Vancouver's appeal?
Well, I think the appeal is that we've tried as a city to rethink how cities are developed and to develop a city that responds to the needs of our citizens, that's a great place to live, that's a comfortable place to live, and that is also trying to be more consistent with the natural environment, creating economic possibilities from all of that. It's a counterintuitive city, and I think a lot of people have reacted to that as a very interesting alternative to the urban experiences they have elsewhere.
What do you mean by counterintuitive experience?
Well, there's always a common wisdom, a wisdom of the day that is evident when you see cities developing. And sometimes a city looks around at other cities and says, well, that's what everyone's doing, that's what we'll do. Sometimes that isn't the right thing for a city to do. Sometimes the city wants to differentiate itself and be different. And that's what we decided in Vancouver starting about 25 years ago, but certainly about 15 years ago. We had Expo 86 in 1986, and from that we thought, well, we really needed to think about our city. We decided, for example, that whereas people were building a lot of freeways and other things to get people from the suburbs to the city, we wouldn't build freeways. And so there are no freeways in Vancouver. Secondly, that we would try to develop the inner city as a place to live. So we've doubled our downtown population over the last 15 years. It's now sitting at almost 85,000 people living right in the heart of the downtown. We decided that density was a good idea, not a bad idea, as we were hearing from many other places. And so we intensified the development of the city, but we also brought along all the community amenities and benefits that people wanted with that density. We used the density to achieve the other things we wanted. And then more recently, we decided that contrary to other cities' notion that everything has to be just about economic development, that we would make our whole city about quality of life, and that we believe that the economic development would come along with that. So those are some counterintuitive kinds of moves.
You mentioned density as one of the defining characteristics of Vancouver, and you say that was by design. What was your rationale for density?
In principle, if you can more intensively use land, then it takes pressure off of fallow land and undeveloped land and green land. So just from a general point of view, it means that you have a chance to be more consistent with your impacts on the natural environment. Secondly, we know that density also creates people close enough together that you can get them out of their cars, so that you can start developing a whole urban system that is not built around primarily the car. Yes, the car is in the equation. It's not edited out, but it becomes one of many ways to move around, and not the best way, not the cheapest way, and not the most convenient or the fastest way to move around. Thirdly, we learned that as people came together closely, there were much greater opportunities to create the kind of spontaneous culture that makes a city, both at a neighborhood cultural level, but also the general culture of the city, the arts of the city, the music of the city. Many more opportunities just because people are close together. So we've become one of the main features of our city is that we are an ideas-based economy. Our economy creates jobs around ideas and the creating and selling of ideas. And that is engendered in part by the intensification that brings so many more people together. It's those kind of things that have caused us to say that density is our friend.
How did you sell density as a concept? So many people in America fear density.
I know. That is one of the things about North American urbanism, that there is a sense by many citizens that if it's dense, it's bad. We did it a couple ways. First is that we didn't press density into the treasured areas, the treasured communities of the city. We tried to put density in new areas, different areas. Second, as we were doing it, we were extraordinarily careful about design and bringing the design factor into the densification. So I like to say that, you know, normally if you say density, people think of ugly, overly tall, overly oppressive buildings. They don't think of community. They don't think of green. They don't think of domesticity at the street. They don't think of all those factors that can be there and that we've tried to insinuate. So we're one of the most regulated cities in North America in terms of the built form. But that's all directed to an objective of achieving a vision, which is a very high quality of life within a high-density setting.
How do you regulate the urban form?
Well, we have an unusual regulatory framework. We have a discretionary zoning system. It's not big on rules and regulations, but it is big on expectations. So it lays out carefully a quality of life expectation. It codifies our public objectives and then says to the private development community, we'd like you to develop. We're not afraid to say no if your development proposal is inconsistent with our vision, but we'd like to work with you to make it consistent with our vision. That has been the foundation upon which we have then implemented our design ideas. Secondly, though, we bring peer review right into the heart of our system so that architects have their work reviewed by panels of other architects and designers, and that helps us to understand when we're getting great design and when we're getting good quality.
How does the city develop the courage to say no to development?
Well, it just comes first and foremost by having a very strong, well-articulated vision for your city that has been generated through widespread public involvement so that it's a consensus vision. It's strongly held as a vision by most of the citizens, so it's picked up by the politicians. Then implementing it carefully, gently, respectfully, so that people come in and as they're doing development, if they are working consistently and working to achieve the vision, they're getting a lot of help. So that you avoid having to say no in most cases, but it's always there as a powerful reality if someone doesn't want to collaborate with the community to achieve the kind of development that we want. The other thing, though, is it's getting easier and easier to deal with development because what we have illustrated is that there's a lot of money to be made by great design, by great development. Our developers are becoming very wealthy. Our land prices are very respectable. The quality and cost and value of the units is very respectable. And so we're illustrating that good design pays.
What are the expectations or some of the expectations that you've laid out for development?
Well, first and foremost, the building itself has to be a very high quality. It has to relate to the street. We look, for example, to have row housing along our urban streets when we're in multiple family and high-density circumstances. We look for lots of landscaping. We look for quality materials. We look for a lot of permeability, so there's a lot of security and safety at the street. We have very tall but very thin towers because we are always managing views between buildings, and we have very strong view protection policies of our mountains and our water, which are our defining features as a city. When people come to change their development rights, we're looking for an array of public goods which they have to provide as a part of getting permission to develop or getting approval to develop, whether that's we look for additional parks. We've added about 65 acres of parks into our downtown core over the last 15 years. Child care, schools. We've opened a new elementary school downtown because we also require 25% of all housing to be designed to be suitable for families with children, and we now have 2,000 children living downtown. All of the things that a reasonable group of people getting together would conclude are necessary for a quality living experience and a quality working experience, we build right into our regulatory system and look to see those delivered through the process of development.
You were early in the business of making downtown good for housing as an intentional policy. How did you make way for that growth? Did you have to do a lot of clearance, land acquisition, or did you set up the expectation again and it happened naturally?
We did a combination of things, and it was a fairly broad strategy. First, back in the late 80s, we re-envisioned the city, working with our citizens, and came up with this new vision of what we now call our Living First strategy of living downtown, and we generated the guidelines for how that would occur, what it would look like, what communities and neighborhoods would be like. Then we went through a zoning phase where we rezoned 7 million square feet of office capacity in areas that had not been developing for offices to residential capacity. Then in some of our waterfront areas, which had become obsolete from an industrial point of view and transportation point of view, we dedicated those to new communities and new residential development. And in those circumstances is where we required that 20% of the development be made available for low-income people, and we brought in the requirement for 25% of the housing to be suitable for families with children. Then we have had a very selective land purchase program in order elsewhere in the downtown, which is also experiencing residential development, to buy the sites to create the low-income housing that's mixed in. We don't like ghettos in the city. We want to have a social mix in every community. So we don't like ghettos for the rich nor for the poor, and we're trying to develop every community to be socially diverse.
Does it work?
It's working, I have to say, brilliantly. In fact, the satisfaction with our city is higher than it's been before. The densification has been dramatic, but it's not even on the political agenda. All political parties and political organizations are quite supportive. We're insinuating bikeways and new transit because we've built a land use pattern which is very, very suitable for alternatives to the car. We actually have less cars coming into the inner city than we had 15 years ago. Even though we've had a doubling of our downtown residential population. It is, in fact, a very vibrant result. And it is, if you visit it, if you come and visit the city, it feels very different. It feels very vibrant, and it feels very domestic. And there's very little vacant land. There's almost no surface parking lots. All of those things that you expect to see in North American inner cities, you won't see. So it's very successful.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Larry Beasley. He's co-director of planning and director of current planning for the City of Vancouver. You say that it is absolutely necessary to ensure the cost of public utilities and facilities will be borne primarily by the development that must be served, not the existing taxpayer. Tell me about the techniques you've developed or you've used to project the cost of those public utilities and facilities and then charge the developer for them.
About 15 years ago, we did an evaluation of the facilities that we needed and what standards we should expect. So we looked at child care, we looked at parks, we looked at community centers, all the things that you would think about that are in a community, and we set some standards. And then when people come in to ask for changing development rights, for example, changing industrial areas to residential areas or commercial areas to residential areas, we then say to those people, you need to meet those standards. as an integral part of doing development. When you make those decisions, particularly if you're dealing at high densities, the decision creates a great deal of land value wealth, an increase in land value. And a part of that land value increase can come to pay for those facilities while still providing the developer with ample profit. There's a difference in the profit that comes from development and increases in land value that come automatically. We never touch the profit from the development, but we ask the developer to share in the increases in land value that come with the public decision. In some areas, we don't have that option because the zoning is already basically in place. And so we insinuated a second program that was called a development cost charge so that new development pays into that program, and then that money is deployed to buy additional parks, community centers, childcare, replacement social housing, et cetera, the things that are needed in the city, including utility infrastructure as well. In all of our developments, we have a public art requirement, so always we're embellishing the environment with public art. And so it's these measures added on top of the economics of development, always being very mindful of making sure that the development remains very competitive and very economic, that is really the way that we handle it. So, for example, my planners understand urban land economics and development economics. They know what pro forma analysis is. They know how much money is being made, and they know how much might be expected to be invested back in the community. Developers early on in the process were not too happy about this. They worried that it was taking away from their profits. In recent years, most developers are actually quite sanguine with it. And the reason is that it's creating communities that are much more valuable to market than they could ever do by themselves. Because it turns out when people are buying housing products, they're not just buying the housing, they're buying a community. They have to have a place for their children to go to school. They have to have a place for their children to be looked after school. They have to have parks. They have to have all of the factors that are needed in a community. And if those factors aren't there, the consumer is not going to buy.
When you speak about public art and the requirement to include public art, I think I've heard that some of that can be public facilities like theaters and galleries and first floor spaces. Is that correct?
We have two different programs. We have one program which is simply a public art investment requirement, and that is really going into the physical art that embellishes the city. We also have opportunities where people can have bonus density, a little bit more density on their site in exchange for either providing on their sites or investing in cultural facilities and other social facilities. So there's different kinds of techniques. And so, for example, we have a new Vancouver International Film Center, which is just opening because we happen to find a site where the density could be increased, and in exchange for that increase in density, the developer, working with our film festival organization, could deliver the film center a wonderful facility, 8,000 square feet facility, with their development. In some other cases, a developer is getting an extra tall building, and with the land value increase that's created by that extra tall building, that developer can afford to invest in, whether in one case a new sculpture garden, in another case a new theater or a rehearsal theater, I should say, and other things like that. So, again, we use a variety of techniques through our zoning powers, working collaboratively with developers. Again, this is not a program that's laid on negatively to developer. There's always a quid pro quo to achieve the benefits that we could not achieve just through the tax base.
It can't be a coincidence that 10% of the people in your city walk to work. That is very high.
Yes, it's an amazing number. And not only that, well over a majority of trips in the inner city are taken in other than the car, so either on transit, walking, or biking. People are not in their cars. When they move in the inner city, they can sell their cars. I'll give you a fact that's been very helpful to our citizens. If they move in the inner city, and let's say they have two cars in their household and they sell one car, they can afford a mortgage of over $100,000 more, which means they can buy a better housing product, better home, and it's not a consumer investment anymore. It's an investment in their family's future. These kind of things are very good for consumers, and it has caused people to get out of their cars and to start moving around much more conveniently and efficiently, I might say, either on foot or in transit.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, The figures I saw from your website, only 22% of the people in Vancouver use public transportation, which is actually 10 percentage points lower than in San Francisco. Are you trying to increase that number?
Oh, definitely. And what's happening is San Francisco is ahead of Vancouver. It's a much larger city. It's ahead of Vancouver in transit. We are just building the grid of rapid transit, which one has to have for a very good performance and use of transit. We have a very good bus system, and it's very well used, but we are just now, and it takes several generations to build those very expensive rapid transit alignments. And as we build them, we notice that transit ridership just goes up. It automatically goes up because they're going to very popular destinations. We also have a regional plan, which is a series of town centers, higher density town centers, which get connected through this new rapid transit investment. So I think over time that number is going to be changing. In fact, our whole transportation plan assumes that it is going to be shifting dramatically as the new rapid transit is built.
You've used the term, let congestion be an ally. What do you mean?
Well, we do believe that that one of the contradictions of modern cities is that as we built more and more accessibilities to the suburbs, instead of revitalizing the inner city, it tended to drain the inner city. And it tended to make it easier for people to live in the far suburbs and then move back and forth for work purposes to the inner city. We believe that congestion can be your friend in the sense that it causes people to think about those decisions. And many, many thousands of our citizens are deciding that the trip to and from work is too difficult, and it would be way better simply to live in the inner city. And by virtue of doing that, getting completely out of the statistics on commuting, and also having much more time with their families, and generally helping with all of the issues of environmental impacts that comes with the car.
You've said that the underlying theme in Vancouver's planning strategy is to bring out the competitive advantages of the urban lifestyle in preference to the suburban lifestyle. What are those competitive advantages?
Well, you know, it's amazing to watch as a person who I myself was raised in the suburb. It's amazing to watch what happens to people and households living in the heart of the city. It's amazing to see how much more time they have with their families because they're not spending that hour each way to and from work. It's amazing how comfortable it is when you can go walk right down a few steps down the street and get all your day-to-day needs to shop. It's amazing how when most of your friends live nearby and you walk to visit your friends, it's amazing the health implications we're now finding as the researchers do the work and discover that high-density cities are healthier cities. These are all the benefits that come from high-density living, provided you do it in a very high quality. If you just say we're doing high-density and stop there, it will backfire on you. There will not be a competitive advantage, and consumers won't buy it. It has to be that visceral reaction that you have when you come to the inner city, look around, and you say to your loved one, we could live here. We would prefer to live here. And it actually turns out to be more comfortable, more exciting, more interesting, and to some degree more economic.
What are the biggest mistakes cities make, Larry, that wipe out the advantages of urban living?
Well, the biggest mistakes that I think North American cities have made for well over a generation was the assumption that the inner city was just a place to work. It has become almost a cultural norm to think that when you grow up and marry or a couple and have children that you must move to the suburbs. And cities, public policy, urban policy has reinforced that, has caused that to be the only choice. And I think that is the biggest mistake that cities have made. It is, in fact, the rediscovery of the inner city as a remarkable place to live as well as to work and as well as to create your culture that is going to change the cities of the future and probably is going to also save the natural environment.
Larry, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
My pleasure.
Larry Beasley is co-director of planning and director of current planning for the City of Vancouver. After a short break, we'll return to talk to Otis White about paying to parade. And in the second half of our show, we'll talk with Tim Jones, CEO of Toronto's Artscape, about their upcoming conference, Creative Places and Spaces 2, The Risk Revolution. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, it's summertime. There are lots of parades. Am I just naive for never having heard of the fact that you pay to be in a parade?
Well, you do if you're in Boston. You know, and I've often wondered when I would see a parade, and you'd see the city council member or the mayor or a state legislator marching along with a sign, usually held by someone right next to them that identifies who they are and what their office is. I've sort of wondered, well, how did that person get to be there? I mean, why is that city council member there and not another one? And I thought, well, maybe they had done something nice for the people who would organize the parade. But as it turns out, at least in the city of Boston, the politicians are not there by accident. They actually are asked to and do pay to be in parades. Now, the amount of money depends on the size of the parade, obviously the crowd that can be expected there, and also where they are in the parade. It's better to be up front. But in one parade that the Boston Globe looked at recently, the minimum amount you had to pay to be in the back of the parade if you were a politician was $200. And if you wanted to be up front, you had to pay $1,000. And that's how you came together. Now, this all comes up. This has been done apparently for years and years and years in Boston, an old tradition. It came up because there's a mayor's race on this year, and there is only one political figure in the city of Boston who isn't asked to pay, and that's the mayor. And the mayor apparently is invited to all parades and invited to be right up front. So Mayor Tom Menino's primary opponent has been saying that's not fair. She has to pay to be in the parade, and the mayor ought to pay to be in the parade.
Well, that seems reasonable.
Well, not the mayor.
Okay.
The mayor, for obvious reasons, thinks it's just a great tradition and he'd like to continue on.
Ah, the perks of the office. Now, one city council member said he was fine with the paying part. It was the walking part that he'd like to do away with.
Yeah, he told the Globe, he said, you know, I would pay not to march. I have this radical idea for parades. The people in the parade ought to be able to stand still and the spectators walk past us.
Oh, the arrogance of office. We'll talk to you next week, Otis.
Okay, Carol.
You're listening to Smart City. Tim Jones is Chief Executive Officer of Artscape in Toronto. It is a nonprofit organization engaged in real estate and program development for the arts and creative sector. And coming up September 30th and October 1st, Artscape will stage its second Creative Places and Spaces Conference in Toronto. Its theme, The Risk Revolution. Artscape provides space for artists to work and live. What have you learned, Tim, about how to do that successfully?
Well, I guess when we started in this business, the organization was founded in 85, but when we got into the development business in the early 90s, the theory was that you could throw a bunch of artists together and the magic would happen, the incredible kind of revitalizing sort of impact on communities. And we quickly discovered that that scenario didn't magically unfold unless we worked very, very hard to make it happen. So really, our business is as much about developing and sustaining the creative milieu as it is about bricks and mortar and real estate.
How do you do that?
Well, it really sort of is a process of building trust with a tenant base, building and designing an environment that's conducive to creativity, and then figuring out how to connect the players within it and then to link them to their surrounding community. I guess it's a specialized field of expertise that we've developed over time. And we've spent quite a lot of time and resources in research partnerships with Canadian universities looking at the dynamics of the creative ecology and what makes it work.
Well, what does make it work? How do you create an environment for creativity?
Well, it's a a complex challenge, really. You know, I was on a panel with an American architect in New York recently, and he challenged our panel to say, you know, I was on the panel with Gene Lutfi from the Brooklyn Academy of Music Cultural District, and he challenged the notion that sort of you can create an environment that's highly creative, and suggested that these kind of things happen just organically and kind of magically appear out of the ground. But anybody who's spent any time sort of developing creative communities knows that it's a much more complex challenge than just waiting for magic to happen. It really sort of is a whole bunch of different factors that need to come together in order to make and sustain creativity at a community level or at a city level, for that matter. The right psychological environment is a key part of that mix. But of course, it also takes investment in various forms and policy intervention. It requires space, it requires leaders, it requires connectivity, it requires a sense of place. So there are a whole set of factors that need to come together in order to build and sustain creativity at a community or at a city level.
At the practical level, at the action level, you mentioned two things I want to ask you about, and I want to ask you how you do them. You said create the right psychological environment, and then you mentioned the need for connectivity. Tell me how you do that.
First of all, you've got to sort of have an environment that is open to risk-taking. You need an environment where people are free to express themselves. You need an environment where not just artists, but mavericks of all kinds, whether they're entrepreneurs, or whether they're restaurateurs, or people in the design business, feel like they want to invest their energy in a place. So that can be kickstarted in an environment with depressed real estate prices, but it can happen in other places as well. So it's about figuring out how to create the conditions. So affordable space can be a key to making that happen in a community. And introducing affordable space in an environment where there is none might be a catalyst to help kickstart a psychological shift. You know, all over the world, cities and communities are embracing the idea of creative transformation. And there are great examples in places like Tirana in Albania. Do you know the story of the mayor of Tirana? This guy named Edi Rama, who decided that, and of course Tirana in Albania, its capital city, it's surrounded sort of by conflict, deep-seated social, economic, political challenges that they're facing. And he sort of, in looking at the infrastructure around him, which is basically urban decay, crumbling, decided that the biggest challenge that community has was a psychological one. So he convinced his municipal council to invest 5% of their municipal budget in paint. And he set about turning this decayed, falling apart urban form into this multicolored, polka-dotted, and striped environment that looks absolutely radically changed. And his theory was that if you could actually change the way that a place looks, then that might be a catalyst to shift the psychology of the place. Because if you're a kid growing up in an environment that's falling apart, that's in a slum, how do you imagine a better sense for yourself in the future? So they actually started with a couple of buildings. I think that last count, they were at 550 or something like that. And it's amazing when you look at the pictures of this place, because it bears no resemblance to what it was before. And Edi Rama has just, because of this work, just been honored with the world, an honor of the World Mayor of the Year. And it's an example of how a small intervention in the grand scheme of things can actually help to produce a psychological shift, a creative transformation, if you like. Nobody's pretending here, though, that a coat of paint is going to solve deep-seated social, political, economic challenges, but sometimes what you need is a trigger or a catalyst to help shift things in the right direction.
Also, I want to ask you about connectivity. Is it as practical as providing common spaces and newsletters and bulletin boards, or is it something more sophisticated than that?
I think it can be as simple as that, but in big city, sort of big urban creative environments, one of the biggest challenges that we see is connectivity between the different players in the creative world. So you might have a fantastically rich array of museums and galleries and theaters and film business, etc., but they're all operating in silos, and they're disconnected from not only from each other, often from the marketplace. So the challenge is often, how do you sort of bring these players together so that they're pulling in the same direction and able to actually have the kind of impact that they're capable of having at a city or region-wide level. If you look at some of the work that's been happening in the UK, I think it's really instructive on the level of connectivity, because they've spent a lot of time and developed a whole infrastructure, a lot of intermediary organizations whose principal role it is to connect the players within the creative world. And I think it's having a profound effect over there.
At your first Creative Places and Spaces conference, a research project I think your organization sponsored was presented that attempts to show the spillover effects of artist spaces on surrounding real estate. What did you learn in that study?
We learned that the impacts are much more complicated and complex than we ever imagined that they were. We tracked, I think, 117 different indicators. Some were economic, some were social, some were quality of life and neighborhood character sort of indicators. Some were demographic indicators. And so we looked at a period of change over 5 years surrounding three different projects, two of our buildings in Toronto and a large theater development in Vancouver. And we were really looking to provide some weight to the anecdotal stories that are now widely accepted, that investment in arts infrastructure produces positive economic and social benefits. So we wanted to demonstrate how new facilities helped create a rise in real estate prices that contributed to the economy and sales tax revenues and property tax revenues and those types of things. But we also wanted to look at how sort of attitudinal change in the neighborhood was had been affected as a result of that. So the research, now mind you, it was only three case studies, but it really pointed to many of the things that we know anecdotally, that there's a positive economic impact as a result of investment in cultural facilities, and that we also saw things like, in some cases, crime going down, and a general sort of sense of well-being in the neighborhood, a sense of improvement in the neighborhood going up. So it did sort of reflect what we've come to believe is the case from an anecdotal point of view. We're now taking that research and seeing how we can apply it in other ways, and how we can actually create a toolkit for local communities to build and sustain creative environments. And that's really, I think, what the next outcome of that piece of work will be.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Tim Jones. He's Chief Executive Officer of Artscape in Toronto, the organization that is sponsoring the upcoming Creative Places and Spaces Conference in Toronto, September 30th and October 1st. And its theme is the Risk Revolution. Tim, what does that theme imply?
Well, we had some fun as we were thinking about this year's conference. And I should backtrack for a little bit and explain that there was a 2003 iteration of this conference that was really meant to focus on arts infrastructure development seen through the lens of creativity and the huge new global interest in it. And some of our speakers at that conference, Richard Florida, Jane Jacobs, and Glenn Murray, immediately took us to a much more philosophical place than just focusing on arts infrastructure development. And it altered our thinking about the creativity agenda, really. And we began seeing it as a much broader theme, certainly not something that's just germane to arts and cultural development, or certainly arts facilities development, but something that really has an impact on every aspect of human endeavor, not the least of which are governments and the private sector, education sector, all social services, for that matter, the environment. So we began thinking more broadly about creativity in our preparation for the second conference. And so we looked for themes that would be relevant across sort of those areas of interest, being government, the private sector, the nonprofit sector. And risk aversity was the thing that rose to the top, it seemed, of everybody's agenda. That, you know, we live in a world where, despite all the kind of hopeful talk about creativity and how it's reshaping our world, some of the messages that we hear from Richard Florida and people like Charles Landry, many of us are still operating in a world that's defined by utilitarian values, that is inherently risk-averse, is operating in silos, is really sort of discourages boldness in every way, shape, or form, and is also averse to making an investment in things that really matter to make a difference. So the idea of having some fun with the concept of risk and revolution, that it's time now to actually think in a new way about risk and how we can move the creativity agenda forward, was really where the risk revolution theme came from.
Where do you have examples in your speakers on your agenda for the conference of creativity in play, infusing those areas, as you say, government, business, social endeavor that go beyond arts and culture?
Well, we're thrilled to have Dr. Roberta Bondar, Canada's first female astronaut, on our speakers list this time around. And she'll bring a sort of really interesting perspective, both as a scientist and doctor, but you know, also as an astronaut and somebody who's sort of been able to travel beyond our planet and look back in the world. And I think that she'll bring some really interesting insight into the mix. We've also, on our list is Alan Weber, the founder and former editor of Fast Company magazine in the U.S. You know, Fast Company, as you know, has really chronicled the whole IT sector explosion. And they've really been a leader in thinking about the future and creativity and, you know, how it relates to the private sector. So we're hoping that people like Alan and Roberta help to bring some of that to the mix.
Do you think it's finally become okay to talk about creativity in other sectors, for instance, government?
Well, I think it has to be. And I think there are clearly people, key people in our various levels of governments who get it, and others where the penny hasn't dropped yet. In the UK, I keep coming back to that example because the federal government has acknowledged that creativity is the fastest growing sector of their economy. And strategically, what could be more important than the sector that delivers the British brand to the public and the world? So they've understood that for some time, and they've probably have about a 10-year head start in terms of developing the programs, the policies, and the infrastructure to deliver support to that sector.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there are a lot of lessons to be learned there.
It seems to me this discussion gets a little confusing. It begins with arts and culture, and then it expanded to include the creative industries, so to speak, and looked at economically, which you just referred to. But then there's this sort of larger wraparound question of infusing creativity, as you say, into every human endeavor. And it's not about creative industries. It's about trying to push things to new places in all sectors.
Yeah, we're really trying to draw the links between them. And, you know, we've spent the better part of 2 years sort of researching the common themes in these diverse sectors that relate to creativity. And so our conference really this year is structured around those themes, and they include silo-busting strategies. And any sort of forward-looking government organization these days is looking at how do you break out of the silos. Problems like homelessness, which are complex challenges, are never going to be solved by a Ministry of Housing, because homelessness is rooted in mental health issues and poverty, social exclusion, a whole array of different challenges that have to be addressed in a creative way by diverse stakeholders within that field if we're ever going to make any headway there. So that's one example of while the arts and cultural world has its own silo-busting issues, certainly so do governments, and certainly so do private sector companies who are sort of trying to lead the way in their field. So we're hoping to actually look at a subject area like silo-busting and see what lessons can be learned and shared by people who are doing groundbreaking work in silo-busting in different sectors.
Do you believe, Tim, that a civic strategy can be developed that explicitly promotes creativity? Again, not arts and culture and not the creative industries, but this sort of larger question of how can we all be creative and how can we bring that to our various daily lives and the work we do?
I absolutely believe that, but I think that if we think that government is going to lead the charge there, then we'll be disappointed with the outcomes. I think it's got to be a kind of multi-stakeholder initiative, clearly with government at the table, but with people from the private and nonprofit sector. The whole community needs to be involved in an initiative like that if it's going to have any legs and be really successful. Ultimately, if you can get a couple of core things right and get the momentum going in the right direction with people pulling in the same direction, then I think that you'll have results there. But, you know, every city sort of in the world, it seems, is jumping on the creativity bandwagon, developing a creative strategy of some sort. And if it's just something that sits on paper, that's an attempt to brand a city, as a creative place, then I think it doesn't go very far. Places that are actually looking at integrated, multi-stakeholder kind of attempts to around this type of initiative are having more success.
When you talk about getting a couple of core things right, what would those things be?
Well, I think the most important thing is psychology. Understanding the kind of positive psychological attributes that are required for creativity to grow and thrive, I think, is the beginning point for any community. I love hearing the story of Austin, Texas, and their, you know, Keep Austin Weird campaign. You know, that was about creating the right psychological kind of environment for the creative community there to be able to sort of express and be proud of itself. You know, I think that's a fine example of a strategy that's kind of a little bit out of the box, but sort of kind of hits the nail on the head.
What role does Toronto Mayor David Miller play in promoting creativity and risk in your city? I know you said you can't rely on government, but I'm curious about the role that he's played.
You know, he's in his first term as mayor and has been hugely supportive of creativity from an arts and culture point of view, and is still, I would say, sort of feeling his way forward in terms of the larger creativity agenda. The city has just adopted a new branding strategy that really focuses on creativity as its central point. It's called Toronto Unlimited, and I'm hoping that that initiative can actually provide some impetus for some of our various kind of interested parties to come together to develop this kind of multi-stakeholder strategy.
In your latest journal, you quote Toronto's poet laureate saying this: "Finally, let me say that Toronto has succeeded at just about everything except looking glamorous to itself. And by glamorous, I mean a city's attraction to its own uniqueness, moved by the conviction that there is a style of creativity that can only be done here." Do you believe that, Tim?
I absolutely believe that. I grew up in the creative community here, and it's a community to be fiercely proud of. We have such diversity and such a richness of talent here that we haven't begun to appreciate in the way that it needs to be appreciated. So I know exactly what Pierre Giorgio is speaking about. We've not been as good at celebrating our own sort of successes and looking at how they compare sort of across the world as we need to be. You know, you have to start by looking at what's unique and authentic in the city, and that's not big-ticket cultural attractions sort of many times. It's the stuff that's happening in the smaller, the new work that's coming out of the smaller venues and the, you know, as well as the successes in the scientific community. So it's putting all these things together and understanding how our creative environment has actually spawned new thinking in the world.
Tim, thanks for being our guest on Smart
City. Thank you, Carol.
Tim Jones is Chief Executive Officer of Artscape in Toronto. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. A continuing conversation on Smart City is whether new stadiums revitalize cities. This week, City View's commentator Walker Smith has a story of a new stadium's unintended consequences.
After the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta, Fulton County Stadium was demolished and the Olympic Stadium was converted into Turner Field. The Atlanta Braves had a new home. During the demolition of the old stadium, the seats were sold to anyone who wanted to buy one as a piece of memorabilia. My wife Joy and I were season ticket holders, so we were interested. Joy drove to the stadium one day during lunch. There was only one gate open where a lone guard kept watch. Joy asked him where she needed to go to buy a seat. As Joy and the guard were talking, a small female dog was bounding around beside them. The guard told Joy that one night a few weeks before, someone had dumped the dog at the construction site. The men working there had adopted her for the time being, but were hoping to find someone who could give her a good home. The guard gave Joy a long look up and down and thought for a second before asking if she was interested. At first she wasn't. But as Joy was putting the stadium seat in her car, she decided that she was. After all, Joy is an animal lover, so she talked herself into this dog pretty quickly, even though she knew that our cat Fred was not going to like it. As the guard helped her with the dog, a couple of hard hats walked over to make sure that Joy met their approval before they let her drive off with their dog. Joy named the dog Patsy, in honor of Patsy Cline. Joy was taken with Patsy, but unfortunately the same wasn't true for Fred. He didn't think much of sharing his domain, and even after a few months to adjust, Fred remained withdrawn and agitated, so we finally had to give Patsy up. Fortunately, the guy who took care of Fred when Joy and I were out of town, Matthew, was looking for a dog. He and Patsy bonded immediately. The day Matthew came to get Patsy, she trotted off down the driveway and jumped in his truck without so much as a whimper or a glance back. Joy still misses Patsy. Patsy's picture hangs on our refrigerator, and every now and then she calls Matthew just to check on her. Patsy is doing fine. In fact, I think that Patsy wound up in the best home for her. After all, Matthew really wanted a dog, and Fred really didn't. But the fact that we couldn't take in a dog didn't deter Joy from rescuing Patsy. Joy did the right thing, even though it meant some small hardships and a little heartache. Joy was the vessel fate used to bring Patsy together with Matthew. And it reminds me that small acts of kindness and charity have their own way of working. We should always step up when the chance presents itself. Oftentimes, it's never what we expect or intend. But most times, it's what's best in the end. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelevich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to hear Smart City broadcast, sign up for our podcast, listen to archive shows, and register for our weekly newsletter. Thanks to Charles Edwards at Georgia Public Radio for his production assistance. Jeffrey Reddick edits Smart City. Our theme music was created and performed by Robbie Grant and Steve Selvage. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.